In the West, there is a supermarket chain named Safeway. I don't know of it if it exists in Illinois, but in any case, the name struck me as a nice theme to express, to clarify practice, since I'm always looking for, I shouldn't say always, often looking for ways, themes to speak of practice, since I have to do that. I'll use that. Safe way. The way of safety, or the safe way. What is the safe way? Of course, in naming companies, and though many connected with food, with medical devices or paraphernalia, use terms like that. Safety first, first safety. And I don't know what the source of the name is, and it's really not important, except that this is a tendency we humans have to want a way that is safe. If we recast and reframe some of the Buddhist tradition, we can see that in the story of Buddha's, Shakyamuni Buddha's early life, or Gautama's early life, there's the story of his father being told that there are two options for him in his growth by a fortune teller. One is to become a king and a ruler, and the other is to become a great sage. And the father felt that the way to ensure that he does not become a sage, a seeker, a spiritual practitioner, whatever that means, was to have him live a life of luxury. Or, to say it another way, a life of great safety. And therefore, he would not be tempted to do these religious activities, which are a way to deal with, let us say, matters that might challenge or hinder safety. And that Gautama left this life after the encountering of four beings, one who was sick, one later who was old, one who dying dead, and than one who was an ascetic practitioner. But it's, in one sense, about the safety from these uncertain conditions of poverty, starvation, loss, weakness, illness, ultimately death, that his father's activities and his own, you could say, counter activities are exemplified by these stories. that there is a search seeking for safety and a challenge to safety by these conditions, a seeking for safety in wealth, pleasures, getting whatever one wants, and facing sickness despite not wanting sickness, facing aging and loss of abilities, and so forth. We recast it in that way. It's interesting and, I'll say, enlightening for us, encouraging for us to look at what do we think is safe, a safe way. What does it mean in our life being safe? What is not being safe? What do we need to be safe from? And when we take that step, then the question is, can we be safe? How can we be safe? And even more, what do we do in our life to be safe? Or what do we do in our life in response to fear that we will not be safe? Another word for safe could be what is okay and what is not okay with us, for us, for us and for whoever else we apply this for. When do we feel not safe? Does feeling being safe and not fear, or not having fear arise, do those go together? Does feeling, believing, being not safe and fear, does that go together? In a way, we can see many koans that deal with this matter obliquely or indirectly or even directly. In the midst of ongoing change, is there safety? Or is there safety in knowing something? Is not knowing unsafe? Is it possible in the midst of ongoing change to be this safety? Or do we attempt to look for something so-called transcendent, something elsewhere? Some of you might remember a koan I once talked about, where a monk asks the master, where can I go to be free from heat or cold? The response, if I say it loosely, is when hot kills self with heat, when cold kills self with cold. But in a way, this koan can be recast as well. How can I be free from fear and what is not safe? These are in a sense general, but in a sense they're very specific practice questions for each of us. Whether we cast it in terms of feeling safe or not feeling safe, or the more surface question about particular things that a person says or doesn't say, does or doesn't do, whether to me or just in general, whether when certain things happen in the world, do I feel unsafe or safe? And then, is it accurate? Is my fear, my sense and judgment of what's safe or not safe, accurate? Or is it a product of something else? Some sort of beliefs and attachments that don't serve me, but rather serve creating suffering, creating unsatisfactoriness in all sorts of aspects of my life, lead to me or others doing harm or being harmed. See? Does what I do, and it's always important in terms of our own practice, is that, say, skillful for keeping me, us, safe? Does my maneuvering so as to avoid even the whiff of not being safe work? Does it make me, others, safe, or does it make for more entanglement in my life? Does it interfere with my daily functioning and accomplishing what my life is? Does it nurture my life, the life of others, our life? Or does it not? See, clarifying this when we have the sense of how safety appears for us, how feeling safe or unsafe appears for us, we can begin to see what of our action or that of others make us safe, not safe, make us feel safe, which is different than being safe, and more significantly, does seeking safety hinder our life, your life, my life, hinder our functioning, hinder being present, hinder us being who we are? Who is safe in the midst of ongoing change? Who is not safe in the midst of ongoing changing? Is there safety in the midst of ongoing change? Is there no safety? Or what do we look to for being safe in the midst of this? Good. I want to pause now and want us to explore this matter, because in many ways this is a fundamental practice question, a fundamental life question in terms of how we function and what we do. Even in the midst of sitting still, upright, in sesshin, where as far as I know, no one gets attacked, there is no threat to your safety in narrow terms, and yet nevertheless fear and questions about safety can arise for us and be an opportunity in this larger practice container of the present moment to clarify what's so. So I'll stop here. You can change your position, turn towards me if you wish, and we can clarify this, because this is the point, to clarify how and what our life is, and how and what nurtures us being who we are, or hinders us being who we are. Despite the fact that we can't be other than who we are, we can make all sorts of difficulties with habits whose source we do not see, or habits that perpetuate themselves because of unstated beliefs. I shouldn't just say beliefs, unstated body-mind tendencies that in one sense are beginningless, tendencies that are part of this process of cause effect that manifests as our life. We are cause effect tendencies of all sorts. So let me stop. Okay, I don't have to stop very long.
I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go.
Well, I just was thinking about David Bowie today.
Yes.
And he died recently, as people know that.
Maybe you should say who he was.
Oh, he was a, I want to say a pioneer in popular music.
Okay.
He's a very creative person in a lot of ways. His expression and and the way he lived, a very creative life, and a really interesting person. The band that I was in did a couple of his songs, but regardless, I thought of a song of his called "Changes," and one of the lines in the song is "Turn and face the strange." And I think, you know, when I feel the most threatened, I think about it, is when I'm faced with something that I would call strange, a situation that's strange, and I'm not sure where I stand or how to respond or react, or even people that I feel are strange. And I'm not sure how else to describe it, but people who I can't seem to relate to, the way they dress or the way they talk or the things they say. To me, it's strange, and I can't relate to it. And that's tends to be when I feel most threatened and unsafe, to use your phrase.
It's that word "strange" is, in a way, goes with what I brought up earlier. This matter of knowing or not knowing, because strange, in a sense, is another way of saying not knowing, and our fear and unwillingness to be not knowing, despite the fact that that's the intimacy of our practice, is being not knowing. And what might lead to the uncomfortableness which you're describing, and whether we see it in terms of what others are doing, how they look, or what occurs in our own condition, or what occurs in broader conditions and changes of politics, economics, or simple things like job security or health, or in a way, those strange situations in Gautama's life of seeing someone who was sick or seeing someone who was
strange to him,
unfirm and old and weak, or someone who was dying. Those were strange to him. Those were therefore unsafe. And his father had supposedly attempted to shield him from that so he wouldn't be tempted to look for a way to deal with that unsatisfactoriness or suffering that comes from encountering that, or even just being afraid that we might encounter that.
Or we might become that.
Yes, that's encounter.
Yeah.
Encounter in, as our life. That's what we're... Yes. Yes. Interesting. Yes.
So I had Thursday night another break-in attempt on my house. And it was, you know, certainly a time of not feeling safe, although we didn't actually discover it until the following morning.
Oh, were you there when it was happening? And I wasn't aware that you had had one previously because I wasn't here, but that's okay.
About a year ago. And a year ago, we put in all kinds of different little...
safety devices.
Yes. Security enhancement.
Yes.
And so after this one, which we discovered the following morning, in that past year and a half since the last one, you know, some of the little security features have broken, or, you know, batteries have worn out or whatnot. And so I found myself this week getting angry at myself, feeling angry at myself for letting that happen, that the, you know, the various batteries die and whatnot. And this time, as last time, I had all these people, well, did you get your gun? Do you have a gun? You should have a gun. The gun would make you safe.
Okay.
Oh.
Some people believe that.
That's
but
true. I don't.
Good. So?
So I was in the aisle of Home Depot yesterday exploring new little safety features and thinking to myself, you know, this is this idea of getting a gun to make myself feel safe. It's sure I could do that, but it really is not who I believe I am. And that means I told myself a story about who I am, but it's something that has sat strange with me. I always have this response. I'm not really sure what to do, you know, when people, oh, well, why don't you have a gun?
Well, let's leave aside gun. I don't know whether it does or doesn't make one safe, because it has to do with how we feel.
Right.
And the point is, you did these other things which you obviously evaluate and said, this would make me safer, but a gun wouldn't make me safer because of whatever other reasons. What you discovered is that despite what you did, things occur, and, you know, maybe batteries die and some devices don't work. Maybe batteries don't die and still the devices don't work. And there's this all of a sudden situation where someone tries to break in, despite all, and you get to be with that fear. And seeing in one way how you want to say, okay, I need to get new devices and I'm so terrible because I didn't keep up to date with the batteries. But the other part is to be with, even though they didn't break in, to see how much that unsafe feeling disturbs us and how much we do. Now, that's an easy situation in terms of safe and unsafe, because that's a person who is attempting to break in. It's different, or what should I say, it's more difficult to see when we feel unsafe about someone saying something or doing something where they're not trying to do that physical attack. And even having a gun might or might not make one feel safe. And what are we attempting to do to assure ourselves when we're attempting to feel safe? And what are we doing? What do we do extra when you discover, oh, these devices didn't work, or they worked, or they didn't work because I didn't have the batteries? Okay, so now I need to put reminders in my calendar to, will that make it okay? See, that's, so yes, it's fine to do all those things, great. And get a gun, don't get a gun, that's a separate matter. Because even if it's the alarms, or get the insurance, I'm going to be safe because I get my insurance. And what happens? And then it happens, and oh, I've got to now file the insurance claim. Oh, the insurance isn't good enough. Oh, there's these exclusions. But it's what first happened when you discovered that someone attempted to break in right there. And despite all the devices, if three or four people wanted to really break in, those devices have limited usefulness. And then what do we do? Can we be safe? Or what does being safe mean? Being safe means no one's going to break into my house when I'm there. Or no one will break into my house even when I'm not there. Being safe means I will take exactly the good vitamins and minerals and will not get sick. Or I will drink and eat all the food that extends life, and therefore I will, and you fill in what I will. That's the point. Then do what's skillful. You know, go to Home Depot, get new batteries, and do all that. I mean, that's why we have smoke detectors and carbon monoxide detectors and all sorts of other things, and it's great to do all that. Yet none of that's a guarantee. And that's the point that I wanted us to get to, the place of wanting, seeking, searching safety, or fearing in all sorts of ways, despite the things that we do. Fearing what? See, that's the point. Then, you know, the other issues are practical issues, and we can do all sorts of wonderful things. And as someone said to me, the more device, this was someone who was a professional in this, he said, the more devices we come up with, the more devices that those who want to break in develop. And this is also true with all, given all the digital devices that everyone has, as there's some people here who professionally work in that area. You know, there are more safety devices, more virus protectors, more this and that, and there's more ways discovered on the other side. And this is, of course, what we and other nations do as nations. We have an ongoing race to find what's going to ensure our safety, and we ongoingly discover all the ways that they are gotten around by those who want to, as far as we're concerned, attack us or threaten us. So what threatens us is really what the practice is about. What is it that we do that perpetuates threat where there's no real threat, that creates difficulties so that we can't deal with threats because we're so sapped of energy and presence, so that when a real circumstance occurs, we're not present. We're not single-mindedly, wholeheartedly doing our life. Instead, we're constantly doing these other things that hinder us from being able to, when heat kills self with heat, when cold kills self with cold, then life, death. Some of you may know Hakuin, who is a famous Zen master in Japan in the 17th century, who is known for reviving Rinzai Zen in Japan. When he was a young practitioner, he was greatly troubled by the story of a great Chan master in China who was attacked by bandits, maybe while pilgrimaging or at his monastery, and that used to happen all the time. And this was a great master, and you know, he was attacked and killed, and he gave this great roar that supposedly was heard 3 miles away, let us say. And this troubled Hakuin that this would happen to a Chan master. If that happened, then, you know, maybe I shouldn't be practicing. This caused great confusion to him. But that's the daydream, that we are going to avoid those circumstances. It's what happens to humans in various ways. How do we live in a world where that happens to us and to those that we love? In the midst of us doing all the perfect things, despite our having the best safety devices and an arsenal of guns and guards and whatever else, and all the food that ensures safety and health. So that's our practice. So this, you know, this same issue is the issue that Hakuin dealt with in a slightly different form, but still. Okay. This is the issue that Gautama Buddha was being faced with in a different form, but it's the same issue. The same fundamental human issue. It's an issue that we can have when we get an email from our boss that's a little not the way we want it, or we get a call from a family member and they're not quite as we expect. So I'll stop here because this is your, yeah.
And there's the other side of it too, because we have our oldest boy, speaking of strange, only wants strange. And he's only wants danger. He's afraid of what he calls suburban life. So he constantly is, that's his fear of the not strange, the familiar.
Yeah.
And the, you know, situations that he thinks sap him of energy, which is like going to work.
Yes.
Cleaning his apartment, just it'll kill you. You know, it's the number one threat to young men his age is cleaning the apartment, doing dishes. It's gonna kill you.
So the vital life is the one where there's lots of fear and danger. And you get to live how you live with him living that.
Mom and I, like, yeah, I mean, this is a boy who gets hit by a bus riding his bike around like 4 in the morning. I'm sure not quite, what do I want to say? Not totally sober. And, you know, it's one thing after another with him. He's starting to break down. That's good. It's physically breaking down, so he doesn't do as much of it. But there are, just to Ed's point, we are probably a group, more or less, who seek safety. and what's safe to us is the opposite of dangerous. My son and his buddies are pretty much on the other end of the scale. Uh-huh. They seek danger because safety is the killer in their mind. It's all how you look at it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's killing his mom in the process.
And in the midst of that, how do both we practice, and if I won't address him, but there's real practice there too in terms of safety and his fear of safety,
mm-hmm.
or his fear of not the excitement stage, but the non-excitement mm-hmm. life. And there's, you know, one can talk about biological and psychological aspects of it, but that's secondary, because what the real point is, how does this for us practice in our life, and to see how there's many forms of this, and there's real practice for those who live that kind of high adrenaline life or whatever we call it, and to notice when, you know, when your teenager goes out bike riding without a helmet or without a night lights on their bike, or you could pick just simple situations versus even more complex when they're not quite completely sober and they're driving or whatever else, or even just hearing of it the next day. Yeah. So how do we, in the midst of that, if we're trying to avoid that, that's what that koan is. How do we be free from hot or cold? How do we be free from hearing of our relative, child, etc., doing these dangerous things, and be free from the fear that that generates us? Because that's why we want to be free from it. Not because there's just because there's something wrong, but because it generates fear in us. Just like the break-in generates fear in us. Of course, I mean, you know, don't have to get a gun. An easy way never to have anyone break in is not to have a locked house and not to have anything in your house that anyone would want. But but yes. This is why I bring this up, not for anything but to show that this is really another way to discover what we're doing in our life and what is called for in order for us to truly be who we are and to be present as we are, and to see what we do that in a sense hinders us, hinders this life, because ongoing changing in ways that are not predictable, not just in the ordinary ways of getting older and getting weaker, etc., but in completely unpredictable ways, despite our predictions and attempted predictions, they're going to happen in unpredictable ways, means that any place we hold on to safety, any place we're unable to embrace fear when it arises, is going to mean more stress and suffering. And if we're always trying to avoid fear, then we'll get stuck in this always avoiding, whether it's with the situation you've described or with people who say things and do things in strange ways, whether to us or just in the world. Yeah, this is what ongoing change means. It means that everything is subject to change. Every single circumstance is changing, and it's not changing in just the ways that we predict and figured out and want it to. And it's in the midst of that flowing stream that we get to live our life. We get to be in that ocean of ongoing change. See, that's this transcendental, is not going somewhere else, but it is being in this midst of this. See, in the midst of this not knowing, throwing ourselves into it, Not because it's going somewhere else, but because it's right here where we are. Yeah.
If I may, I had a friend growing up around the time I was in junior high school, I think. His name was Leonard Brewer, actually. I remember his name. And he didn't experience fear. He had no fear. He was born without fear.
Yeah, there is a condition like that.
That's right. And he had this. And he was this kind of tall, lanky, geeky-looking guy with horn-rimmed glasses, what they used to call dark-rimmed glasses.
Easy.
And you'd think he'd be easy prey for the bullies, but nobody would mess with this guy because he had no fear. And so I was intrigued by this, and I started hanging around with him. Really a nice guy. And it was really exciting. One time we climbed to the top of the State House building and unscrewed the light bulbs on the red light on the top and threw them off. it was exciting time. And we did these just crazy things, and he had no fear, and it was a very exciting, you know, very appealing, addictive kind of experience.
Until
one day he showed up at my house in the middle of the night, and he had a gash, a cut, it was from here all the way down to here. Deep cut. And he brought me these band-aids and these bandages, and he said, "Hey, could you patch me up?" And I said, "What happened?" He says, "Oh, well, I broke into this illegal gambling den down at the bottom of the, and I got in a knife fight with a guard." Okay, that's it. No more of this. But, you know, it really stood out to me that fear is a necessary and valuable component of what it means to be a human being. Yeah. Without it, we would be in serious trouble.
Yes. Yes. As long as we're afraid of what's appropriate to be afraid of, it's nothing wrong with wanting to be safe. But to be safe from what's appropriate, when you do things like turn on the lights on your car, it's so that you could be safe driving and others on the road can be safe driving. It's not for any stupid reason. There's nothing wrong with that. It's where and how we do things that are unskillful, inappropriate, that cause increased stress and suffering because we misjudge. We so much seek safety. And what are we seeking safety for? See, are we seeking safety for what's impossible to have safety in the midst of ongoing change?
What are we protecting?
What are we protecting? But also, what are we trying to attempt to keep permanent in the midst of impermanence? See, what are we attempting to make be a certain way, despite the fact that things are changing? See, that's the practice aspect, and that's the place where we create difficulties and hindrances where we need not.
Well, Leonard joined the Navy and became an underwater demolition expert. And then he got kicked out of the Navy because this guy's crazy. And he ended up being a smuggler out in Asia, smuggling cigarettes and opium and stuff like that.
Okay.
And then disappeared. Nobody's heard from him since. Just to finish the story.
He disappeared, but you don't know what that means.
I don't know what happened.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, I appreciate the talk on a number of levels, actually. One is the story you started out with. But I can imagine a parent who wants, you know, they want to help their child.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they make that kind of choice. And yet the child has his own or her own life and makes their choice. So and it just kind of points out how we can do all these things, but there's really no guarantee of what's going to happen. That's one thing. But the other thing I just wanted to explore a little bit is about this place, the Zendo, the Zen Center, and as a safe place. Because I can remember when I first started sitting, even though it was something that attracted me to sitting, it didn't always feel safe. You know, to be present didn't always feel safe. Sometimes it felt kind of scary. And I think, you know, to me that's always well, if you talk about killing the I or whatever, however you said that, killing the self, I mean, that's not necessarily the most safest feeling, yeah. You know. So that's another part. And then the other thing just was about decisions that I noticed I've made to be safe, and I can reflect on those and see that, well, actually, that maybe not wasn't necessarily the best thing. I mean, and I'm talking in relative terms. I'm not yes. saying to do the counter necessarily, but I'm just saying that yeah. you know, it's interesting to look at that and what, you know, I'm trying to protect something. I think I can control something by trying to act in these ways, even though I can't. And then it brings up, well, what do I want to do? Because since I can't control it, and I'm doing this maybe to be safe, maybe there's something else I might want to do that might be more skillful or beneficial. No. I don't know.
Yeah. The first point that you brought up is important for us to recognize, and whether it's the first time we sat or the 100th time, that sometimes just being present, just experiencing, just sitting still upright allows for the arising of circumstances, feelings, thoughts, body sensations, which are, quote, scary for us. And that otherwise we might not notice that they're there. And as we sit, and if I say it, deep in presence, some of these might arise. And one of the important aspects of sitting, of practice, of our life, is the ability and the willingness to tolerate and to embrace these, or to run away from them, as sometimes happens, despite the fact that they're occurring within this silent stillness of just sitting, if we say that. Another thing that comes to mind is the aspect of how accurate we are. I mean, you said people wanting to protect their children, which is of course quite natural, and you can see even in this is more prevalent in certain areas than in others, the controversies over vaccination. And some parents want to ensure their children's safety by vaccinating them from these illnesses, which we now have a choice to vaccinate children from, which 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago children would die of, whether it's measles, mumps, etc., etc. And then you have other parents who, for whatever reason, believe that the vaccination itself, and therefore they don't want to vaccinate their children. And then there's the conflict, because those who don't vaccinate are therefore putting others at risk in terms of the basic principles, to the extent that we understand it, of herd immunity and public health and etc. And both of them are searching for and attempting to hold on to safety in the ongoing change world, where there's only limited safety, and even vaccinations only give you whatever 90 whatever percent safety. Even 99% safety means that there's 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000 who, despite the vaccination, will have this illness, may die or be crippled or whatever. Yeah, that's why I bring this up, not for a theoretical discussion, but for us to see and appreciate, one, how it runs our life and how it runs our reactions to ourselves or others, or how it runs others without us seeing it. And part of practice, if I say it that way, is to clarify this. Killing self with heat, in a way, seems strange, but we have to understand that. That's why that's a koan, to see really what is that. Of course, it seems that that's a very strange response, but it's very simple when you work at it as a koan. So, very straightforward. But I want this to be an opportunity. Yeah.
It's interesting to me to hear Mushin say that what he feels most threatened by are things that are strange. Because it seems to me like my experience is just the opposite. Usually the people I'm close to. One big I guess big is not the right word. I would say enduring struggle that I've had with that has been in the context of being a parent. When Andy and I got married, I was very sure that I never wanted anything to do with being a parent. And then, as you know, started to get older and time was sort of running out, I remember talking to somebody about this and my fears about it. And it was probably about the time. Well, it was a little bit before I started coming to the Zen Center, but I remember telling someone the idea of having a child was like jumping off into the abyss of uncontrollability. I didn't realize I was already there. That's the thing. I thought
yes.
Something I had a choice about, have a child, have a child. And so, you know, almost 17 years ago, you know, I was pregnant with our daughter, Anne Marie. And we moved from Champaign when I was about 6 months pregnant. And I remember having a doctor's visit right before we left. And I don't know anything in particular that happened at that visit, but I remember standing outside the doctor's office waiting for the elevator, and just really strongly wishing that this baby could be born the next day. Because then I would know that everything was going to be all right. So here we are. You know, she just turned 16 and has her driver's license. And the first time that she drove me a long distance in a car out of Target, all the way I was, oh my gosh, what was I doing? It's dusk outside. It's going to be oh my gosh, why did I tell her to come this way? There's like a double, there's a double turn lane. It's going to have left. Is there any way we can get to Target without turning left? No, not really. And as soon as it got this way, she went off to look at something. I called Andy and I said, you're going to have to come get me. What do you mean? I don't think I can ride home with her again. How about you know? She was fine. She really was. She's an okay driver. I don't think I can tolerate driving in a car with someone that you know they don't know how to drive. I felt like I just have never seen her drive before. You know, I know that she doesn't know. So, I was so, I don't know the word, naive, foolish.
Did you come to get you?
No, I bit my tongue. I thought she'd say, Mom, I don't want to drive because it's dark outside, but no.
So Andy didn't come and get you?
No, she drove us home.
Good.
I mean, he probably would have, but he said, look, I did it with her yesterday, so come on. But I was so naive to think that there was going to be this time that I was going to, oh, everything's going to be fine with that. And it's not just Dean Marie, it's, you know, everything. Sometimes when you've had an experience of not being safe for a long time, you just have this imaginary this fiction that gets created that was just then, and there's going to be some other time, some other situation where it's going to be that way.
Right.
And
there is that as well, that we each have different tolerances and circumstances that lead us to physical, physiological, psychological, and other reactions to feeling unsafe. And whether the circumstance is, quote, really unsafe, or just that we cannot tolerate this amount of unsafety. And that's in part of our practice, and of course varies according to all our past circumstances. That's all the forces. You know, she could have said, Mom, why don't we do this as a roller coaster? I'm giving you a free roller coaster ride. I'm not charging you for the... That's what we do in a roller coaster. We paid it to feel terrified. But, see, our life is a roller coaster in one sense. And all sorts of circumstances, life, death, are... We think if we know certain things, if we've done certain things, then we won't have to feel fear. As long as there's the root of us holding on to what creates fear in our life, our unwillingness or inability to just tolerate the amount of fear that's arising for us, not some idealized, but just then right there is our practice opportunity to see what's skillful and supportive for me in terms of noticing this fear arising and doing what enables me to be present. See, what enables me to be wholeheartedness in this moment, whatever I'm doing, whether sitting still or talking, and to be this experiencing to the extent that, and that includes seeing, oh, I have to leave here because this person is getting out of control. That's fine too, as if it's accurate. But if every person we speak to is ready to get out of control as far as we're concerned, then the problem is not with them. But if every phone call we get is a potential threat, then we have to look, that's something else. And that's part of practice. If every situation of cold is something we have to escape from, then our practice has to be, how do I embrace this cold, give myself away to this take of the universe as being cold? And that's part of what, you know, Faye was talking about, that when you start sitting, sometimes very simple situations are too much. Even though nothing in so-called reality is threatening, yet it can be. That's why each of us need to practice in our own way with our own circumstances and see what the actual practice effort for us that's called for is. Yeah? Anyone who's had kids could have told you that kids are a continuous...
you tried to, but I thought you were wrong.
Well, I did, and you didn't believe me. And you, in your case, you believed it would be different.
Exactly.
See, and in a way, it's wonderful because it gives us the opportunity to be who we truly are. To be, if I say it in this way, more who we are. Or we can't be more who we are. We are who we are with ever, including the fear and the safety and the reactions. It's all just who we are. And yet, if we're blinded by some of that, that causes trouble for us and for others. It causes suffering for us and for others. Or it doesn't. Or, you know, the fear doesn't arise, but then you end up doing things that are problematic or getting yourself killed. It's said, and I don't know how enough about this to say much, that teenagers, particularly males, but all teenagers, have these genetic predispositions of taking greater risks. And that's just a human way to winnow the population.
Calling the herd.
Yeah. Well, some of you might know there's, this is sort of an aside, there's an interesting award called the Darwin Award, which is given to those who make stupid mistakes by which they winnow themselves from the breeding population. From the gene pool.
But isn't it also about attracting mates? For because I mean, in normally left to normal devices, that's when they would be having children.
Right.
16, 17, 18. Now we've pushed it back.
Well, actually, even earlier.
But it's, I read that it was part of, you know, mate attraction, which is this daring, you know, look at me, let's get rock on, and yeah. It's I mean, it isn't attractive. I was attracted to friends who did the same thing that yours did. You're like, whoa.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you have any friends who got themselves killed doing that?
Yeah, they went to Vietnam. They thought that was going to be a lot of fun. And, you know, that turned out so
helpful. And I could say I had friends who did other daring things and got themselves, whether overdosed or in car accidents or with other behavior, got themselves killed early or killed or major injuries when
but it was pretty sexy, I have to tell you. Some of that stuff was pretty attractive, like wow. So I don't know what calling the herd.
Well, no.
Seems like a negative anyway.
That's just one perspective.
Yes.
It's yeah. But the reason I bring it up is not in terms of generalities, but in terms of for each of us to look at what do we seek in terms of safety? What are we able to tolerate that we might at first think is unsafe, and yet by embracing and experiencing, we deepen our life and deepen ourselves, and that are really not a threat to us, despite the feelings that we have and the sureness that we are have that if someone says or doesn't say a certain thing, does or doesn't do a certain thing, that they are, you know, to use the expression, dissing me, doing me in, it will be too much for me, it's intolerable. And therefore some people, because it's intolerable, do intolerable things in return to themselves and others. So in a way, this safety is a flip side of fear, and fear is an important aspect that both encourages us in practice, and at the same time can hinder us if we don't see what's happening and don't see where it's blinding us to the present moment of our life. Any last comments that anyone wants to make? Yes.
Well, I was just wondering how that relates, what you said and what Spencer said, to the 100-foot pole. And
isn't that what it's about? You got up to the top of a 100-foot pole. How do you step forward? Because the thing that keeps us from stepping forward in our life, and we're all on 100-foot poles at times, is our terror of, you know, falling. Of course, the other side is when we step off and we on our way down the first 30, 40, 50 feet, we say, oh, God, things are okay right now.
So far, so good.
So far, so good. Okay, good. Thank you. All the time, stepping off 100-foot poles. That's our practice.